This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street, our virtual Main Street, all across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, the calendar says July is almost gone, so it's time to assemble our panel of seasoned veteran journalists to talk about the stories that have been making headlines during the month of July. And of course, a regular on our show, because he's a regular every Friday to begin with, is Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's news director. He joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
And on the phone from Crosby, North Dakota, Cecile Wehrman. She's with Journal Publishing there. Cecile, good to have you with us again.
Oh, glad to be here.
And Jack Zaleski is sitting right across from me in the Fargo studio. Jack is a columnist for the Forum of Fargo Moorhead. And Dave, let's start with the story that was making news across the state of North Dakota today, this plan by North Dakota legislative leaders for an infrastructure proposal in front of the election. The proposal's made at any rate.
The proposal was made, and they're going to be using oil tax money to do this, creating a couple new buckets at the end of the food chain, so to speak. $115 million for cities, $115 million for counties and townships, and another $50 million for airports. And the legislative leaders say the reason they're doing this is that oil is coming in over forecast, not only in price, but also in the amount of barrels being produced. And they think that that could be sustainable. It looks like it could be around for a while.
Now, 1.2 million barrels or so, that's pretty much where we are now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, and probably going to 1.3 from what I'm hearing from some insiders in the oil industry.
And this is for essentially impacts from the oil industry across the state, or is this some other? What's the logic here?
The logic is that there's been a lot of money given to the oil patch for infrastructure projects. And the legislative leaders, they say they're hearing it from Fargo, from Grand Forks, from Minot, Bismarck, other areas saying, hey, what about us? We need some infrastructure projects too. So this was one way they came up with to try to fund some of those projects.
Well, Jack, it's always nice to have some money thrown your way, I assume.
Oh, yeah, and the mayor of Fargo said as much, that he's called this thing a game changer. But there's a smaller logic at work here, since this is a pre-election announcement. Part of this, the smaller logic, might be Al Carlson trying to save his seat in his district.
He had a close one the last time around.
He did. Mm-hmm. And it shook him. He was unhappy. And, you know, there is kind of a raw political kind of thing that goes on in this time of year, as you're all aware. And the timing could be questioned, on that factor.
Cecile, you're up in oil country. What's the reaction there?
Well, I've had not a lot of time to digest what they're proposing. I think it's appropriate that the rest of the state share in some of the oil money. I think that's only fair, as long as it doesn't take away from the continuing needs in the oil patch, because, yes, a lot of money's been thrown our way, but I wouldn't say that we're completely where we should be. We heard a lot throughout the boom. We always seem to be behind in what we needed, and we're always having to go beg for more and ask for different allotments of the oil impact funds. And so as long as it doesn't take away anything from what we continue to need out here where it's being produced, I mean, it's totally appropriate.
Cecile, this is Jack. Some of the stories that have come out of the oil patch when there was a slowdown, the last, 3-4 years or so, when there was a kind of a slowdown in activity and all the kinds of frenzy that happened when oil was at its peak boom. Some of the reporting took the approach that this was a time to catch up for the for cities and counties to catch up on infrastructure, catch up on the projects that had been proposed, get them built. Take a deep breath and all that. Has none of that happened?
Oh, I think it has, definitely. But then you also have to look at the fact that these trucks continue to pound the roads.
Oh, yes, sure.
Continually. Mm-hmm. Just as an example, Highway 2 north of Williston, I mean, that road, it seems, has been continually under construction for the entire length of the oil boom, mm-hmm. and now a stretch of the road that I swear, I mean, I haven't gone back and looked to see, whether 6 years ago or 7 years ago, they laid concrete on this one portion, but it's like, oh my gosh, they're redoing, you know, to, in my eyes, they're redoing a portion of the highway again. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So it's not like, okay, we caught up and now we're okay. This is an industry that is heavily reliant on trucks,
mm-hmm.
and those trucks are going to continue to pound township roads and impact those political subdivisions, are going to continue to impact county roads and our state highways.
Mm-hmm. Well, just huge traffic, it basically is wear and tear. And I know somebody in the contracting industry who says, I think it is it 15 years? Does anybody remember 15, 20 years for normal highways, and that's what, say, the life cycle is?
These are not normal highways.
But these
anymore.
Are not normal highways up there. They said the life cycle of highways in the Bakken due to the truck traffic is probably more closer to about 5 years. So
right. And you know, they are what they're doing right now to the stretch right out of Williston is they're making one side of it, or the second side of it, concrete, which should last a lot longer. And probably the last time they did it, which wasn't, like I say, all that long ago, it probably was just another layer of asphalt. But it's just amazing to see that this construction just continues and continues and continues, and it just seems to be a never-ending cycle.
Cecile, when we were throwing out ideas to chat about during the editor's roundtable today, one of the things that you circulated was you were really curious as to why an ad agency is involved with rolling out a state infrastructure plan, and I think that is worth chatting about a bit here because, you know, when I introduced the topic, I did – There is an election coming up, so there does seem to be a relationship here between this announcement and what's coming in November.
Right, and I wonder if Dave knows what the relationship there is, and whether is this something that happens all the time now? Is the state engaging an ad agency, or was this because it truly is a campaign announcement?
Well, this was basically done by the Republican caucus. The Republican caucus has contracted with Audney Advertising to help it spread its message. So I guess you could say it's that way. In terms of the state has a separate contract with Audney Advertising for tourism. So, you know, Audney is pretty involved in state government, not only on the, you know, information side, but on the political side.
Okay. Well, let's talk about another big issue that's out there that has national implications. That's the trade war that has developed between the U.S. and China in particular, but other countries are implicated as well. And the big effect in North Dakota, at least the one that we've been talking about over the past several weeks, has been soybean growers. And now we've got the Trump administration coming out with what is essentially a $12 billion bailout proposal for soybean growers.
That's exactly what it is, and you know, farmers, soybean farmers, especially those who have some affinity for the president, bristle at the word bailout. But that's what it is, and it's $12 billion to start with. To start with, that isn't going to go very far considering the losses that soybean farmers have already taken. You know, some estimates are soybean farmers at the current prices, given what's happened to their market, have already lost $200 an acre, and you start multiplying that times tens of thousands of acres, and you see the size of the loss. So we have this interesting contrast of listening to people who have been in the Trump camp, Trump voters, associations, farm associations, farm groups that are fans of the president, trying, you know, mightily to justify what's happened with the soybean situation regarding China, and now the bailout, which, by the way, I think is being funded by the Commodity Credit Corporation. If I remember that correctly, that was a Democratic initiative many, many years ago.
And, you know, we've been talking to a few producers up here this week about it, and they don't – The ones right in our area apparently are already contracted and feel fairly confident that they are going to be okay. They're not too concerned about the tariffs at this point. But one thing that we learned, because we have quite a few producers who are into pulse crops, is that this could ultimately impact them as well. And so, I mean, it isn't just soybeans. I mean, that's the buzzword. That's what everybody's talking about. But it has the potential to impact all of our commodities. And I guess from a non-farm standpoint, the farmers are making the point that, well, why should the taxpayers support this payment when it's the government that's actually taken the action that has caused this problem?
Yeah, there's a great irony here in that it's the president's trade policy and his talk about trade, whether there's policy or not, just the talk about trade that has affected the markets. The tariffs on steel are going to affect farmers and anybody who uses steel, builds grain bins, tractors, farm implements. That's going to cost farmers. And so you have a problem created by the president and his policy, and now he comes to the rescue to solve the problem that he created.
Exactly.
I know that there are people who think the president is right on all this, trying to rattle China, but the impact of it can't be denied. It's his trade policy is hurting American producers, consumers, users of steel far more than it's hurting China.
But I would say though that from the people that we've talked to, not necessarily ones that are in our article, but just around town, they are willing and believe in the overall process of what Trump is trying to accomplish. In that, one of the reasons commodity prices are so low in many cases is because of unfair trade practices, and so they're invested in the idea of trying to right that ship and get a fair playing field, and are willing to go a certain distance in absorbing some of the pain in order to accomplish that.
And there is some irony here in the sense that there was this tax law that was passed that was, trumpeted as providing significant relief to all taxpayers in the nation. There's some argument about who benefited more than others. But that said, you've got this happening now and the price of everything going up as a result. I mean, today there was a story in the Washington Post or the New York Times, I can't remember which, saying the price of Coca-Cola is going to go up because the aluminum cans that it's sold in is costing more to produce. And individual retailers of Coca-Cola will have to decide how much they're going to have to increase the price. So there's this other tax. We keep thinking of tariffs as something, but they're a tax. They cost us money.
Well, so, just think of it in terms of back-to-school shopping at Walmart. Walmart prices are going to be going up for most of the things that Walmart imports from China, including school supplies, clothing, things made of plastic like backpacks and pencil carriers, all those things. And so the poor schlub who thinks he had a bargain getting a $200, $300 income tax cut from the Trump tax cut is going to see that disappear in the increasing costs of the things he has to buy for his family. She has to buy for her family. And so, this is this is not necessarily a good thing for American consumers at this point. And it's hard to see how it's going to be good because you have American companies who are supposed to benefit from this also raising prices in tune with the tariff price, with the cost, with the companies who are rising prices because of the tariff. So, everything rises. Tariffs have always done that historically. You read it, you read about them. Tariffs don't work. They don't work. They cause dislocations in the economy, in global trade. They cause dislocations, and those dislocations translate into costs for consumers.
And they get in the way of what has been a long-time narrative of the Republican Party, which is free trade, and that kind of thing.
Well, the Republican Party since the Trump era has no narrative.
Right. That's Jack Zaleski. He's a columnist for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. We also have with us today Cecile Wehrman with Journal Publishing in Crosby and Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director in Bismarck. We'll be back with more of our Editor's Roundtable in a moment.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about Mill Jenkinson.
My mother, who at the age of 86 died a week ago, and although I was not very eager to talk about that on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, because who knew my mother? David, you suggested we do it, and we have spoken about her in connection with Jefferson's own views of life and mortality.
Yes, I insisted, and I think you saved part of the best for the podcast intro. Life is a...
A man hanged in a cucumber pickle. That was Dr. Johnson's view of how we somehow managed to go on in spite of our the depths of our grief. My mother was one of the strongest, most independent, most autonomous people that I ever met. And, of course, I thought she was immortal. She died suddenly without pain. And as she said, when I moved her into her latest apartment, I'm going to leave here feet first. That's precisely how she did it.
You talk about the great effect she had on your life.
She and I became naturalized North Dakotans. All that and much more this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're holding our editor's roundtable. It's the end of July, after all. We do this once a month. And with us, Dave Thompson in Bismarck, our news director, Cecile Wehrman on the phone from Crosby with Journal Publishing, and Jack Zaleski with the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. He's a columnist. Dave, let's talk about the significance politically that North Dakota has this time around. We've had the president here a couple of times, most recently in Fargo, and we've had Mike Pence, the vice president, most recently in Grand Forks.
That's right.
This is ground zero for the Republican Party because there's a big race here.
It really is, and you talk about, you see this a lot, is that the Heidi Heitkamp versus Kevin Cramer race is at like one of the top three races in the country people are keeping their eye on. Republicans do think there's an opportunity to pick up the seat. However, Democrats say that Heidi Heitkamp being more of an independent, more of a, shall we say, grassroots-type conservative Democrat, that it's going to be hard for people to pick up. And you're getting a lot of the outside interests who are flooding television, radio, newspapers, Facebook. I see that a lot with a lot of ads. And we're going to see more, I think.
We have seen a lot of ads, Jack. You had seen one. You've seen one set of ads in a particular light. So why don't you just share that?
Yeah, well, I imagine these ads are being broadcast across the state for both camps, Cramer and Heitkamp. Some are good and some are not. But so far, in my mind, having watched these kinds of campaigns for a long time, the best ad so far in the cycle is the one where Heidi Heitkamp uses former deputy sheriff, former police chief from West Fargo, Arlen Rasmussen. And he stands up straight, looking very distinguished, opens with saying that I voted for the president. And then he essentially, in so many words, very unsubtly, says Cramer's a liar because he's misled the president on Heidi Heitkamp's vote on law enforcement issues. Coming from Rasmussen, who's highly respected, looks good on camera. The ad is short, direct, in 1, 2, 3. It's a good ad. Whether it has any effect, it's hard to tell. But it's a well-done ad, and so far in the cycle, I think one of the best.
Well, that's the big question here. Mm-hmm. Are any of these ads truly effective? Because, Cecile, you mentioned, you know, how ingrained people are in terms of where their positions are. I mean, whose vote's going to change in the next several months?
Right.
That's the question I have.
And they have so much money to throw at this. And, you know, it's funny to be talking about this because obviously newspapers are going to benefit from some of this advertising, probably much more so than we have in recent election cycles where so much has been poured into television. But from what I understand, all the TV time is purchased. I mean, there literally is no TV time for political campaigns to purchase anymore in North Dakota. So that means they've got to put those messages somewhere else. And so some of it's going to, a lot more of it's going to go in newspapers. You know, and, I mean, this has an interesting trickle down because that also means that we have an increased news budget. And we need to put more news in the paper alongside those ads.
Well, you know, I people complain about, and, you know, Dave's heard this for years and so have you, Cecilia. People complain about the spending on these campaigns and how awful it is and it should be curtailed or they should be government, they should be funded with public money, all those sorts of things. But when you think about this money coming into the state, it is, as the economists say, new money. It's coming into the state. And some people have begun to view it as economic development. And so, it's not just newspapers and broadcast. It's hotels, motels, it's gasoline, it's public relations firms, it's all those things that are associated with a campaign that pump money into the economy. So we can complain about it and not like the ads and object to their content, object to their direction, object that they're dishonest or whatever. But in terms of money coming into the state, it's significant.
It's not like we didn't know this. We knew this. Right. We knew this about a year ago that this was going to happen. It's going to be an expensive race, but then you see the amount and you say, "Wow!" But it is. It is what it is.
Well,
hasn't it been estimated that it's going to be the most expensive or most expensive per capita race in history?
Yes,
I've seen that several times. Yes.
And the thing is not only is it not like we didn't know this was going to happen, but also we in North Dakota all know Kevin Kramer and Heidi Heitkamp very well.
They've
both been on the public scene and as serving in various capacities for decades. So to think that any of this is going to sway very many people is really hard picture.
Let me throw a real wild card question out there, because recently, in the last day or so, we've been hearing about Senator Claire McCaskill being targeted by the Russian election effort to disrupt her campaign or her office, and she's in a toss-up state in Missouri. Well, we've got a toss-up state here. At least it's considered that at this point. How confident is the Secretary of State of North Dakota? Are the people who tally ballots? How confident is Heidi Heitkamp about the security of her server and all that? I mean, shouldn't everybody be on alert right now?
If you are a smart person, you would be. One thing North Dakota has an advantage, and I've heard this from several sources, not only the Secretary of State, is we do not have voter registration. The only state in the union that does not. So that maybe a hedge against some of this, quote, meddling, end quote. But no matter what, you have to be careful. And if you remember correctly, during the 2016 election, the Secretary of State did report that somebody had tried to hack into North Dakota system.
Yes, and of course, the biggest disruption seemed to be in social media. So maybe all of us need to be on alert about what we're going to be seeing on our Facebook pages or whatever as this campaign heats up. The disinformation stuff that was out there in 2016 might be back in droves.
Yeah, we like to.
I don't think it ever left.
Yeah,
I mean, we like to think that we're not vulnerable to these kinds of things because no one's paying all that much attention or has in the past paid that much attention to North Dakota. But the Heitkamp Kramer race is a race of national consequence. I think there was a rather extensive story earlier this week, above the fold in the New York Times, I heard about it from my friends. I didn't see it myself, but so the attention it's getting is more than races in the past have gotten. Just like the McCaskill race in Missouri and the Manchin race in West Virginia.
West Virginia, yes.
So and a couple of others, but so
we don't know. We had some network news people in Crosby last weekend talking to people about the Kramer Heitkamp race. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what put us on their map other than we went heavily Trump in the last election. So there was that. But they seem to be wanting to play off of the divide
right,
county.
Right, I saw that.
Name.
Yeah.
Okay. That was
I saw that,
pretty funny. But, about Russians attacking North Dakota or thinking that they wouldn't be interested in what's going on here, it was just a couple months ago that we saw a photograph of an NPR reporter used in a Russian meme campaign that was a disinformation campaign. So that was going on, during the DAPL protest. So, and that whole social media thing affected that story greatly. So, we're definitely on their map, I'm sure, as well.
Cecile Wehrman is with Journal Publishing in Crosby, and Jack Zaleski is with me here in the Fargo studio. He's a columnist for the Fargo Forum. Dave Thompson is our Prairie Public News Director. We'll be back with our Editor's Roundtable after the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota House Democratic leader says he's taking a deep dive into the GOP leadership plan for funding infrastructure development statewide. The Republican leaders are proposing three new buckets for funding from oil taxes. $115 million would go towards cities' infrastructure needs, $115 million would go for counties and townships, and $50 million would be set aside for airports. House Minority Leader Cory Mock of Grand Forks says Democrats also see a need for infrastructure improvements statewide. But Mock says a proposal to give townships money for roads and bridges was vetoed in 2017 by Governor Burgum, and the GOP majority failed to bring that up for an override.
If it's a priority today, it should have been a priority over a year ago.
Mock says he's also concerned these new buckets are at the bottom of the list when it comes to funding from oil taxes.
If we see a decline in production or a drop in prices like we did in 2014, for the next couple of years after that, they're not going to receive anything. And this is a priority. I think we need to, if we're going to invest any of our oil resources into local communities across the state, we need to move them high into the formula, make them a priority, and make sure that they get a dependable source of funding, or as dependable as it can be, so that they can build their communities with peace of mind at the end of the day.
Mock says Democrats have some of their own ideas about infrastructure funding, and they're willing to work with Republicans on the issue. The president and CEO of North Dakota's state-owned mill and elevator says he's expecting the mill will have a good crop of wheat and durum to work with next year. Vance Taylor says that's despite the survey from the Wheat Council, Quality Council. Taylor told the state's Industrial Commission the council's numbers were quite a bit under the prediction made by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in July.
They had wheat average at 41.1 bushels per acre and durum at 39.3, which is close to what we had last year and quite a bit lower than the five-year average. I've got a gut feel that it's going to be somewhat better than that. The wheat, especially up here in the Northeast, looks really great. So we'll just have to see how the crop finishes up here, but irregardless, it'll be, you know, it looks like we'll have a good crop here for the mill with something good to work with for next year.
Taylor says the council believes there are lingering effects from last year's drought conditions. And State School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says North Dakota doesn't have any schools that are considered persistently dangerous. A school can be persistently dangerous if it has gun violations or violent criminal offenses on school grounds. A school that expels a number of students for violent behavior can also be labeled. The federal government says states must report any dangerous schools they have, and parents must be informed about the label, and students have to be given a chance to transfer. Basler says North Dakota has never had a school designated as persistently dangerous.
There's a lot of factors that go into the fact that we don't have any persistently dangerous school in our state, and that is a group of really caring and committed teachers, caring and committed principals and superintendents and school board members. I think it's also the fact that we have caring communities that really play a role all together, working together to make sure that our young people are safe.
North Dakota education advocates are still taking precautions. Teachers and administrators get regular training on spotting signs of trauma and suicide risk among young people, and security features have been recently added in many school buildings. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for being with us today for our Editor's Roundtable, which includes Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, Cecile Wehrman from Crosby, where she's with Journal Publishing, and Jack Zaleski here with me in Fargo. He's with the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. Dave, let's talk about a development that has been getting a fair amount of controversy because of its adjacency to one of North Dakota's premier attractions, Theodore Roosevelt National Park. That's the Davis Refinery, which is now under construction.
Right. And the surprise, if there was one, is that the construction began on the Davis Refinery. The people who are putting in the Davis Refinery claim it's going to be the cleanest refinery on the planet, but there still is some concern about view shed from the park, and also from any kind of pollution that might happen that's that close to the park. And they went ahead and started construction, but it's still causing some controversy among some of the more environmental groups as well.
Well, it's a reminder that the price of oil is up and there's money to be made, I guess.
That's true.
Dave, maybe you can answer this. I don't understand the mechanism. They can, the way I understand it, the permitting process is not fully complete. Is that right?
That is correct. They were waiting for an air quality permit.
And they can, while waiting for that permit, obviously start construction.
They can start construction. They don't have anything that's going to generate any kind of potential air pollution.
I see.
So that's what they can do.
But it makes you think there's a wink and a nod. I mean, why would they start construction if they weren't expecting to get the go-ahead?
I think they are expecting. I've talked to the CEO a couple of times, and he says he doesn't see any barriers to getting that right now. So.
And as I recall, the CEO was planning to build a house in that area.
That's correct. Yes, he is.
So he's sort of putting his real estate where his opinion is, I guess.
Right, right.
All right. Well, it is a reminder, though, that the oil patch is doing well again because the price of oil is still hovering around $70 a barrel, and that's well north of where it had been.
You know, it's interesting right. You should say that because I did get wind of something that happened that there's an older oil field in Bottineau County that has been kind of dormant for a while, but they're going to use horizontal drilling there, and this is not deep oil. It's 3,500 feet, and they said the reason why you could do it now with horizontal drilling is the price of oil is north of $70 a barrel.
Mm-hmm. So, and I've been by those donkeys up there. They look old. It is an old field.
It is an old field.
And now this is going to be revived, apparently. That's news to me.
That's what I understand, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I just heard in Tioga yesterday when I was at a meeting that the motel where we happened to be having this meeting was talking about how they're 100% every night now. I was like, wow, that's really something because I know that lodging had been way, way down in the oil patch for a long time. And I'm sure, a lot of apartments are still open and things like that. But you're definitely starting to see some signs in Williams County anyway that there are people going back to work and more people around, more traffic around. Tioga's sales tax figures definitely reflect that. Now, up here in Crosby, we're still seeing declines. Our last quarterly sales tax report showed that we're still behind where we were last year even, and last year was way down.
Well, and you mentioned in your notes, Cecile, that Crosby has been featured nationally, being named to a list of underrated towns by MSNBC.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? And we tried to track it down and find out where or how, Crosby rose to the top of the list among all of the towns in North Dakota be named the most underrated town in the state.
Well, pat yourself on the back.
what does underrated mean, Cecile?
I'm not sure, but we're just excited that we were mentioned.
Okay.
Well, having been there in the last couple of years for the press convention, two, 3 years ago, I agree.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
It was a fun little thing, but like I say, we have no idea of what kind of stock to put in it because we don't know what the test was or what the criteria was that we met.
Well, it makes a good headline, that's for sure. Dave, you had a story earlier this week. The ethics measure will be on the November ballot in North Dakota. This is one of those things that was out there gathering signatures, and it's been talked about for years and years, and apparently we'll get a vote on it now.
Yeah, it was a biennial thing for a number of years in the legislature because North Dakota is only one of a handful of states that does not have any kind of ethics commission, and the Democrats especially have tried to get it through the legislative session for a number of sessions, and it doesn't go anywhere. Finally, a group decided they were going to put it into the Constitution, so they gathered signatures. And it will be on the ballot this fall. And I probably shouldn't predict this, but I honestly think it's going to pass.
I agree, Dave.
I hope it does.
Yeah, what surprised me is that they got the signatures. I mean, they had help getting the signatures, which is legal, but they got way more legitimate signatures than they needed. I mean, it wasn't even close. And so it got on the ballot, and they modified some of their original proposals. So they took the money factor out of it, I believe, or part of it anyway. And so it's going to be more palatable to voters. But I think, as you and Cecile say, I think it'll pass too, for a couple of reasons. One is that there is a sentiment afoot in the land,
right?
Not only in North Dakota but everywhere, but certainly in North Dakota too. It is not harmful or unreasonable to have someone or some mechanism to look at the conduct of the people we elect in office. And it is not good enough for our leaders to say, listen, I'm a good guy, I'm a good girl, we're as ethical, we're as pure as the driven snow. And in some cases, they may be as pure as the driven snort. So I think, this probably has legs.
And how do you campaign against it?
Right.
It's going to come out.
I was asking the organizers, how do you expect from pushback? And they all said, you know, I don't think people can push back because how can you campaign against ethics?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about medical marijuana. You had a story on Monday, Dave, that the Bank of North Dakota won't provide banking services for medical or recreational marijuana. There is that measure that's out there that has yet to be affirmed for the November ballot, but they apparently did have enough signatures. We'll see whether or not that passes muster. But about the medical marijuana, mm-hmm. there had been a suggestion that maybe because North Dakota has this unique status of having a state-owned bank, that they could sort of circumvent the federal banking issues that have complicated the financial end of medical marijuana and, for that matter, recreational marijuana in other states.
Right. And other states have looked at the North Dakota model. Could they adopt it for their state to maybe do this? But talking to the bank president, Eric Hardmeyer, he said they took a look at it, and they just feel that the risks are too great because it is still a Schedule I drug, and they're concerned that, you know, there could be some ramifications because the Bank of North Dakota does work with local lenders in terms of some of the loan guarantees and loan backups and things like that. And they're kind of worried that although the Bank of North Dakota does not face direct regulation from like the FDIC or anything like that in the federal level, there could be ramifications for their business model too. So they just said it was not worth the risk.
Well, what is the sense about that recreational marijuana bill? I mean, we've talked about this in the past. It's the signatures have been turned in. I guess we're waiting for the decision to be made whether they're adequate all of that. The sentiment out there at this point, I'm not hearing a lot of blowback about this, and I was expecting a fair amount.
I'm not either, and I know that the organizers are very confident they can get it through. Number one, because there is kind of a wave to get recreational marijuana in the United States. Number two, Canada has just legalized recreational marijuana. And number three, there was a lot of angst and anger after the legislature put a stop to the medical marijuana thing to rewrite the law. So they said there are three good things that may be in their favor.
Well, you have to look at these kinds of issues as the kind that bring people to the polls, too. So,
that's a good thing. But I am personally just so against recreational marijuana. I think that it is just going to become a scourge on our society, and especially for young people. I've just seen it at work in our community, in people I've known for decades, and how it's impacted lives, and I shudder to think that it might pass.
You know, as a child of the '60s, I find myself shuddering when I agree with Cecile on this. You know, people say, "Well, you know, we'll legalize it. We'll treat it like alcohol when prohibition ended." And you know, and when you think about that, and when you use the alcohol model or the alcohol example, and we really think about it, and ask law enforcement what their primary problem is when they go to crime scenes, it's alcohol. So let's not assume that just because it's legal, everything's going to be fine. Alcohol is a scourge, and it's legal, marijuana. You know, I know most of my friends and a lot of people that I would not even expect to think about this issue like the idea of recreational marijuana. And so I'm a bit of an outlier on this, I think I'm a bit of an outlier on this, but I feel about it the same way, I think about it the same way that Cecile does. It's in the long run, it's damaging.
Well, when alcohol was illegal, it was a scourge too.
Mm-hmm. It still is.
Yeah, true enough.
Yeah.
We've got a couple of minutes here to just get caught up on the Watford City tornado, Dave. That happened July 10th. There was an infant was killed there. Lots of people injured, and certainly many of them displaced from this Prairie View RV park near Watford City. But I think the issue that's come up around this is the early warning system.
That's correct. If I remember correctly, and Cecilia might correct me if I'm wrong, that park did not have any kind of outdoor warning system. Was that correct?
I couldn't swear. I have not seen any reporting to that effect.
Well, the other issue is the weather radar,
that's
too.
That's right, and the weather radar.
Right, see that. And that is true not just down there, but in this corner, that we do not have good coverage up here. at all.
You've got Minot and Glasgow, Montana as the weather radars that cover that area. And from what I've been reading, it's not great at assessing risks below 10,000 feet because of the distance from your corner of the state.
Right, and I mean, this is the second time for Watford in what, like 5 years?
5 years.
It's not an actual tornado, you know. It certainly shows that this is an area where those things can develop and that, you know, there's a growing population there.
So there's an argument, perhaps, for the placement of a new NOAA weather radar in a part of the
state. I think they should put it in Crosby.
Okay, very good. Because it's an underrated city and it needs a new enterprise. All right. We're going to have to leave it with that.
All right.
That was Cecile Wehrman with that wonderful idea for economic development for Crosby. She's with Journal Publishing in Crosby. Jack Zaleski's been with me here in the Fargo studio. Jack,
Doug, that was a public safety idea.
That's
not economic development.
That's absolutely right. And Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director, always with us in Bismarck. Thank you, Dave.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up, Matt O'Leary with a brand new movie.
It was the week in which the leader of the free world screamed in all caps at Iran, warned about Russia meddling in the 2018 elections, and could be heard on tape negotiating a payoff with his lawyer. Thank God scientists found water on Mars. At least we know there's a pool at our new home. I'm Faith Saley, in for Peter Sagal on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
Well, the summer movie season is well underway, and we've got another big one that's out there, Matt, Ant-Man and the Wasp. This one actually looks like a lot of fun.
It is fun, Doug. It's kind of a follow-up to Ant-Man, which was kind of a surprise hit 3 years ago, and Marvel again proving they have long tentacles. They can go Guardians of the Galaxy. They don't just have to do Iron Man and Captain America. Captain Marvel will be next March with Brie Larson. So even these side films that where the stakes don't seem as high make money. Now, I took a couple weeks to see this because we were waiting for my son's friends to get back from a trip, and they wanted us to wait for them. We always go opening weekend. It's making good money, but not Avengers money, not Black Panther money. And that's fine because it really doesn't have the gravitas of those films. And when I say stakes being high, Doug, the world isn't in danger in Ant-Man and the Wasp. It's almost its own separate film set away from what's going on in Infinity War, which we've already talked about this year, where Thanos – I don't know if the statute of limitations are up that I can reveal what Thanos does at the end of Infinity War. I guess I won't say. But there's a lot of drama that's being set up for next summer's fourth Avengers film. But again, this is a follow-up to Ant-Man. Paul Rudd again plays Ant-Man. This time we have the Wasp, played by Evangeline Lilly, finally getting a starring role. She was so good in the Hobbit films. Michael Douglas back as Hank Pym, the creator of Ant-Man and the Wasp. The plot this time, Doug, revolves around trying to find Hank Pym's wife, who disappeared in what's called a quantum realm years ago when Evangeline Lilly's character was a tiny girl, and Michelle Pfeiffer plays Michael Douglas's wife. So that's really the plot of this, is trying to find her and bring her back to modern life because she's existing in kind of a separate universe, a separate time warp, but they can't find her. But of course, Hank Pym's got some ideas. He's on the run now. Paul Rudd is in house probation because he sided with Captain America in the Civil War film when they went up against the Avengers. He chose Cap's side, and so he's under house arrest. But, of course, you know that's not going to last too long. He's going to sneak out to help Hank Pym. Lawrence Fishburne turns up in this one as Hank Pym's old rival Bill Foster, who's kind of shepherding a ghost character who's been afflicted by some things, and they're trying to help her out as well. And then there's some other bad guys trying to get a hold of Hank Pym's information and what he owns and things like that. So there's not really a villain in this one, Doug, and that's kind of a weakness in the film. It's really a personal story. There are some side villains they have to deal with, but really it's about finding Michelle Pfeiffer's character and bringing her back. But I liked it. It's breezy. It's funny. It's funnier than some of the other Marvel films like Black Panther. And, you know, the byplay of Lillian Rudd is good. Michael Douglas, again, is very good. And once again, Marvel proves, Doug, they can get big stars. Michael Douglas, Michelle Pfeiffer, to be in a comic book film. Nice little film, kind of like middle of the road or sub-average, below-average Marvel. But still, if you've seen all the Marvel films, you have to go see it.
Well, there's a little science fiction here, too,
oh, yes.
Isn't there? I mean, like, these Ant-Man is getting very small.
And he can get very big, too.
Uh-huh.
There's some good jokes about that because sometimes he can't control his suit or Hank can control his suit and all of a sudden he gets really big. And there's a fantastic set piece later in the film where he's basically walking around San Francisco as a giant in the bay. And that's quite amusing and well-handled as well. But yeah, there is more technical science fiction in this because of Hank Pym's character and trying to find his wife in the quantum realm, trying to go inside the quantum realm to find her.
Even talking quantum.
Yes. So people, you know, your real comic book aficionados will enjoy the science fiction part. Again, this is not the best Marvel film ever. It's sort of setting up next summer's Avengers because, again, this film exists kind of separate from Infinity War. But I do warn people you need to stay for the credits because, again, it is going to tie in to what happened with Thanos and the Avengers in the May film.
And Marvel keeps adding more female superheroes as well.
Yeah, this was nice to see Evangeline Lilly really get a, in the title, Ant-Man and the Wasp. And that was, you know, Black Widow hasn't had her own film yet. So this was a kind of a nice thing that was done there. I really like Evangeline Lilly. She's a good actress. She's very good as Hank Pym's daughter and really has co-screen time with Paul Rudd. She does a lot of butt kicking in the film, you know, saves him a couple times. So that's great. So very nice to see Marvel giving Evangeline Lilly co-top billing with Paul Rudd.
So you expect another sequel here with Ant-Man and Wasp?
Well, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in this fourth Avengers, Doug, uh-huh. because Thanos has really done some awful things in Infinity War. Let me just say that. You still need to go see the film, those who haven't seen it. And so that's really setting up next summer and setting up Brie Larson's appearance as Captain Marvel, who's really going to be coming in as supposedly the savior to all the heck that broke loose in Infinity War. So I don't know how Ant-Man and the Wasp fit into next year's Avengers film. Nobody knows except the directors and the producers and the screenwriters.
But at least in the most recent one, no Ant or Wasp was swatted?
Well, you have to go see the film.
Okay.
Again, this all ties in with Thanos' demonic plans for the world. So that's how you need to see it. But up until that point, it's very breezy. It's funny. Michelle Pfeiffer is very good. She doesn't have a lot of scenes, but you really believe that this love affair with her and Hank Pym is real. Michael Douglas, you know, getting up there in age, but still he's got the Michael Douglas gravitas that we expect in a role like that. So if you're a Marvel fan, go see it.
All right. I'm going to go see it.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to Ant-Man and the Wasp. I like Paul Rudd and Evangeline mm-hmm. Lilly, that Michael Pena. Pretty good
yeah,
cast.
Michael Pena almost steals the movie. Can I just say that, Doug? He is so funny as Ant-Man's buddy, and he is hilarious. He's got a couple scenes that are he wants like a super suit, and then he says, maybe I could just even have a suit without powers that just looks good. You know, just he's so funny. So I forgot to mention that. Thanks for mentioning him.
We all want one of those.
Yes.
Okay. Well, here's the Oscar trivia question for Matt Olien this week. All of these stars won an acting Oscar in 2017, except here are the four I'm going to give you: Emma Stone, Ryan Gosling, Viola Davis, and Mahershala Ali.
Ryan Gosling did not win for La La Land. He was the only one of the four.
You got it. Yeah. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 27th. On this date in 1944, Orrin Olson was buried at a nameless cemetery in Italy, a long way from his beloved farm near New Rockford, North Dakota. Orrin loved the farm, and he especially liked working with horses. When World War II came, two of Orrin's brothers stepped up to join the service, and another went to the West Coast to work in the shipyards. Recently married, and with a father in his 70s, it was somewhat assumed that Orrin would stay home from the war and take care of the farm. It was not to be. Orrin's draft notice came, and he reluctantly reported for duty, ending up in the Army Air Corps, destined to be a pilot. The training was hard, and letters back home told of his fears of washing out of pilot training. He needn't have worried. Orrin was smart, good mechanically, and a hard worker. He easily passed the multitude of tests to get his wings. Olsen was sent to the Mediterranean and started flying missions with the twin-engine B-25 Mitchell bomber based out of Corsica. Orrin's letters told of his difficult bombing missions and the fact that he didn't care for the Germans shooting at him. He wrote in anticipation of completing his 50th mission, after which he could come home to see his wife and a baby girl born while he was away. On July 26, 1944, Olsen received orders to bomb a bridge over the Adige River, several miles west of Verona, Italy, to halt German reinforcements from reaching the Allied lines in the south. Orrin dived with several other planes to strike the bridge, but his plane took a direct hit in the left engine. Olsen fought the controls and ordered his crew to bail out. Bombardier Anthony Quartuccio, turret gunner John Montoro, and co-pilot Melvin Goff safely parachuted from the plane. Olsen rode the plane to the ground and was killed in the crash. It was his 50th mission. Olsen's crewmates were captured by the Germans and spent the rest of the war as POWs. Olsen's family first received word that he was missing, then the tragic news that Orrin had been killed. Orrin Olsen's grave in Italy was discovered in 1947, and at long last, he was reburied near his farm in Eddy County, North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
What kind of lawyer would tape a client? That's what Donald Trump wonders about his personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Put that question to someone who's looked into the life and career of the longtime Trump fixer. Tune in Saturday for that. Trade, Separated Families, and the Fruit of the Drunken Tree. Weekend edition Saturday from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, StoryCorps site manager Jacqueline Van Meter will stop by to recap their month-long stop in North Dakota, and will also share Tasha Carvel's StoryCorps visit with her father, Kevin Carvel. We'll talk with the Bismarck Larks Director of Marketing, Lauren Springer, about a Monday night visit by a well-known PBS character, Daniel Tiger, will be at that game in Bismarck. And horticulturist Ron Smith will answer some emailed questions from listeners. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.